The cool air cut into her nostrils after the steam of the bathroom, and she was aware of Samson's faintly pungent odor. It filled the whole room. She rather liked it, but the giant two-toed sloth would not remain a secret guest for long if every nose led straight to him. She gathered the limp animal into her damp arms and popped him into the scummy tub. The sloth sprawled awkwardly in the water but did not protest. Seizing the soap, she worked up a greasy lather on his back. Samson sat patiently. A fetid odor rose from his grayish hair and hung in the moist air, a stronger smell than her wool coat when it rained on Easter. "Pew, you stink when you're wet," cried Julie.
The author of that slightly smelly scene was Jacqueline Jackson, but it could be you.
The Author Is You, a Wisconsin School of the Air series about the process of writing creatively, is conducted this semester by children's author Jacqueline Jackson. To begin today's program, here's Ken Ost.
Our topic today, as you might have guessed, is smells. And Jackie, I want to ask you right off the bat, have you ever given a sloth a bath?
No, I never have bathed a sloth. I've bathed dogs and cats, and I bathed a rabbit once. And
A rabbit.
He got in some paints, and I started to clean him with turpentine, and then he was upset because the turpentine hurt his skin, so I put him into a tub of water and bathed him, and that was a job because he kicked like anything. And I've bathed a sheep. I think I've scrubbed a pig, but I've never bathed a sloth. So that I had to use my imagination as to what a sloth would smell like when it was washed. But I think that we can assume that any hairy creature, unwashed humans included, are going to make a certain kind of smell when they get washed.
Smells are important in our lives, aren't they?
I do think smells are important to us, but that we neglect smells pretty much. We don't think about smells, and we aren't particularly aware of them. There's a passage in Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows that describes what smell does, say, to a keen-smelling animal. That means an animal that smells, that is able... Now, how do you put that?
Has an acute sense of smell.
That has an acute sense of smell, yes, not one that we smell. Why don't you read that passage about Mole walking along and suddenly getting a whiff?
He did not notice poor Mole when suddenly the summons reached him and took him like an electric shock. We others, who have long lost the more subtle of the physical senses, have not even proper terms to express an animal's intercommunications with his surroundings, living or otherwise, and have only the word smell, for instance, to include the whole range of delicate thrills which murmur in the nose of the animal night and day, summoning, warning, inciting, repelling. It was one of those mysterious fairy calls from out the void that suddenly reached Mole in the darkness, making him tingle through and through with its very familiar appeal, even while as yet he could not clearly remember what it was. He stopped dead in his tracks, his nose searching hither and thither in its efforts to recapture the fine filament, the telegraphic current that had so strongly moved him. A moment, and he had caught it again. And with it this time came recollection in fullest flood. Home! That was what they meant, those caressing appeals, those soft touches wafted through the air, those invisible little hands pulling and tugging all one way.
Look at all the words that he uses to describe the powers of smell, the caressing appeals, the soft touches, the telegraph filament, the electric shock.
The little hands.
The little hands pulling him. Smell is a sense that is somewhat different from our other senses in that it has a more elusive quality. For instance, if you remember something, what somebody said, you're remembering a scene, you're remembering specific words. When you remember something that you have seen, then you have the sight in your mind's eye. It's a definite sort of thing. But I'm sure that everybody, even fairly young children, have experienced having a whiff of something and not being able to identify what that whiff means to them, and yet knowing that that whiff has some sort of power, that smell means something to them. It doesn't happen with me very often, but every now and then there is this whiff of something that carries with it a strong emotional feeling. And then I rather desperately try to think, where did I smell that? What is that reminding me of? What is that telling me? Like these little hands pulling mole. And for a moment you see mole doesn't know what that means. And then suddenly it comes to him, home. This is the smell of his home that he has suddenly gotten. I find that it's usually a disappointment that I try very hard, rapidly, to think, what is this? What is this meaning to me? What is the memory associated with this smell? But usually it's gone, disappears almost as fast as it came, and I can't identify it.
An association between the smell and a previous event, and then you smell it again and wonder, what was the event?
Yeah, you don't have the picture in your mind, no, necessarily, or the sound in your ears, but just the smell in your nose. I've had smells that I am very fond of. Probably my favorite smell is one that I haven't experienced in many years, but it was the smell of my grandmother's basement. We lived on a farm, and they had a root cellar, an earthen section to their basement, and in the root cellar were potatoes and carrots and apples and things of that sort, and I don't know, as I was too aware at the time, that it was all these vegetables and fruits plus the earth that was making the smell that I liked. But frequently, when I was in my grandmother's house, I would go down to the basement all by myself and go into this root cellar and just stand there a moment or two, sniffing, and then come out again. And in recent years, I've gone down to that same root cellar, but all it smells is dry and dusty. Nobody is putting carrots and potatoes and things like that there. And I've realized that there are certain other smells that are associated with this particular smell, which makes me realize that my favorite smell is a pungent, earthy odor.
I was a city boy, but I know in those days when I was a kid, we would buy bushels of apples rather than we do today, and quantities of onions and vegetables of this type. And they would be put in what we called a fruit cellar, and go down, and I would do the same thing, just inhale. It was great, just great.
I read something once about smells that intrigued me. It's something that we would all realize if we thought about it. Unlike our sight, where if we get used to seeing something and we no longer notice it, we can jog our senses and notice it afresh. And the same way with hearing, if a certain repetitive sound is going on, if you live next to a railroad tracks, you get so you don't even notice that train, but you can notice it. That smells, when you have smelt a smell for a while, your senses become deadened to it, your olfactory nerves or whatever it is that causes you to smell, so that if you are in a house, say, where cabbage is being prepared for supper and daddy comes home and opens the door and says, wow, cabbage for supper,
right.
You realize that you haven't been smelling that cabbage for a long time.
You're used to it. Yeah.
And furthermore, even if you try to smell it, you know, it doesn't come through to you strong, cabbage. So that here is another interesting property of smelling. But I think anything has this deadening effect, as I said, the cabbage. And I recall when we were kids, the manure and the straw would be allowed to pile up in the calf barn over the winter. They'd just throw fresh straw on top of it. I discovered later that manure is very warm. It keeps animals warm, and this is in Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's book, where Wilbur sleeps on a manure pile because it's so nice and warm. This is the place for Wilbur. Anyway, come spring, some of the hired men were pitching the manure out of the calf barn, and the stench was just terrible. It was stronger than even I like. And we kids dared each other as to which one could stay the longest in the calf barn while they were cleaning out the manure. And so we all marched into the calf barn with exclamations and holding our noses and so forth, and stayed in there and gradually began talking with the men that were pitching out the manure and talking with each other and interested in other things. And after a while, it suddenly occurred to us that we had completely forgotten that we were daring each other to stay in the calf barn on account of the terrible smell. This is why I imagine people can endure living in places that smell bad. We've used some words here with smell. The words that Kenneth Graham uses, where he says we only have the word smell to describe, we do have a few more, odor, scent, certainly not a very large vocabulary of them, but there are ways of describing smells in terms of other things that help us to get a sense of the smell. For instance, I mentioned manure. The manure on a field, as it's going on with a manure spreader and you catch it over several fields, is a lighter smell than standing there in that calf barn, which was a very heavy smell. And yet there are smells much lighter than the manure even across the fields. Plum tree that you catch on the wind in blossom is a very light smell. There must be other words that we could think of to use. Pungent, I said, was my favorite type of smell.
Acrid.
Acrid. A furnace. The ashes of a furnace have an acrid smell. There are sharp smells that clear the head. How would you describe Vicks? or the inhalers that we use when we have a cold. The cutting smells. There's a marvelous passage in Dr. Doolittle that I'd like to read, where the dog Jip is trying to trace a man who smokes black rappee snuff. And Jip says that this is an easy smell, that he will easily be able to locate this man even though all the birds in the world had not been able to see him. And so Jip stands up into the wind and smells. He started muttering to himself, "Tar, Spanish onions, kerosene oil, wet raincoats, crushed laurel leaves, rubber burning, lace curtains being washed, no, my mistake, lace curtains hanging out to dry, and foxes, hundreds of them, cubs, and..." "Can you really smell all those different things in this one wind?" asked Dr. Doolittle. "Why, of course," said Jip, "and those are only a few of the easy smells, the strong ones. Any mongrel could smell those with a cold in the head. Wait now, and I'll tell you some of the harder scents that are coming on this wind, a few of the dainty ones." Then the dog shut his eyes tight, poked his nose straight up into the air, and sniffed hard with his mouth half open. For a long time he said nothing. He kept as still as a stone. He hardly seemed to be breathing at all. When at last he began to speak, it sounded almost as though he were singing, sadly, in a dream. "Bricks," he whispered very low, "old yellow bricks crumbling with age in a garden wall. The sweet breath of young cows standing in a mountain stream. The lead roof of a dovecote, or perhaps a granary, with the midday sun on it. Black kid gloves lying in a bureau drawer of walnut wood. A dusty road with a horse's drinking trough beneath the sycamores, little mushrooms bursting through the rotting leaves, and... "Any parsnips?" asked Gub Gub the pig. "No," said Jip, "you always think of things to eat. No parsnips whatever, and no snuff. We must wait till the wind changes to the south."
He was a very selective smeller, I guess as all dogs are, huh?
I'd suggest Jip's exercise in smelling as something that would help all of us to be better writers, but also to have more interesting lives, that we selectively smell. In other words, that we go out and smell and notice what we're smelling and think about what we're smelling. The more variety of smell we have, the more vocabulary, say, of smell we'll have when we come to write things down. we could go to places where there are interesting smells or notice the variety of smells that we have in our own situation. Wet mittens on a radiator, for instance, are very distinctive. We always think of bakeries and things like that.
In terms of writing, you mentioned earlier that there weren't so many words that describe smells, but there were some, and we could use them. But just as you did a moment ago, other ways to describe them are using similes to say it smells like a something.
Yes.
Or other, to communicate with the reader. Or are there other ways to harness the words about smells?
I think comparing smells to other things is an excellent way. I came across a scrap of paper the other day that some child had written, and all it was this phrase, "the wormy smell of rain." And I was so intrigued by that I copied it down. And you see, it's one of the smells I like. It's a pungent type smell. Well, now, I don't know as any of us have ever picked up an angleworm and smelt it, but the angleworm is associated, you know, with earth. The times I've gone fishing, you run your finger down there into the earth in your tin can to get your angleworm out, and so the smell of angleworm is mm-hmm. mixed with earth. And of course, when the rain comes down, why, the earth gives up its odors, and so there is the wormy smell of rain. But the smell is quite different from the smell of a parking lot when the rain is coming down and the dust is beginning to run down.
Rain has many different smells, yes, depending on where you are. And
we could notice this, the smell of this rain, the smell of that rain, the smell of this room. How does your classroom smell? What is its distinctive odor as compared to the classroom down the hall? You know, every house has its own smell. You can walk into some house, and even if your eyes were shut, you could say, oh yes, this is so-and-so's house. Dogs, of course, have a much greater property, and all keen-smelling animals do. And here would be something we could try in our writing, to imagine ourselves an animal or a creature that has a very keen sense of smell. A good title might be Dog for a Day. If you were changed from your human form into a dog and had the whole day to pursue dog activities, I think that your nose, as contrasted to your human nose, would suddenly come into prominence, not just in its position on your face. Another thing we could do with the writing, and maybe a good place to begin, would be to think about the odors, the scents, the smells that we like. Compile a list, say, of 10 favorite odors, like my root cellar odor and manure, the smell of clean sheets that have been dried in the sun, not in the clothes dryer, when you climb between them at night just after your bed's been freshly made, these sorts of scents and smells. And then try another list of odors that you do not like. And then when you have these odors, you can go perhaps from there to the descriptions, like the wormy smell of rain. Try putting some of these odors into a poem or into a description of a room or scene or something like that, and try to make the odors as vivid to the reader.
And if you can write about freshly baked bread, to make the reader get that certain look on his face, then you know you're doing all right.
Yes, that's what we want, to give this experience of our own pleasures or displeasures with smell to the reader and help him either to recollect that he too has had that smell or else get some idea from our description of what that smell is like.
Fine, Jack. That sounds like fun. Now, all of you young writers out there, keep us informed as to what you're doing. And with that in mind, this is for teachers now. The last two programs in May, we'll be reading a lot of the writing that's been sent in.
This has been a program in the creative writing series, The Author Is You. conducted this semester by children's author Jacqueline Jackson. Your reader is Ken Ost. This is the Wisconsin School of the Air.